Hello. On this week's program, Susan Lewis considers a new multi-venue exhibition celebrating the 20th century Pennsylvania sculptor and furniture maker Orton Escherich. A conversation with James W. Hilty, author of Temple University, 125 Years of Service to Philadelphia, the Nation, and the World. We listen back as David Patrick Stearns explores the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band with composer Jennifer Higdon. Higdon cites the Beatles as a major influence on her work. And we speak with sculptor Sean Kenny. A collection of animals he's created from Lego bricks is on show now at the Philadelphia Zoo. That's all I had this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
A new multi-venue interdisciplinary exhibition is celebrating a pioneering 20th century sculptor and the artistic climate of Philadelphia that nurtured him. Best known as a furniture maker, Orton Escherich practiced a variety of artistic disciplines before achieving fame for his freeform sculpture. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis takes us to Orton Escherich and the birth of the American modern.
25 miles west of Philadelphia, off the highways, beyond parkland and pastures, a road curves and climbs up a forested hill. At the top, nestled in the woods, is where artist Orton Escherich lived and created the innovative forms, carved mostly from wood, that prompted his peers to call him the Dean of American Craftsmen and paved the way for the American studio furniture movement. Paul Eisenhower, curator of what is now the Orton Escherich Museum, says prior to Escherich,
you had the traditional furniture maker copying traditional styles and doing beautiful reproduction kind of work. And then you had the industrial designers using industrial techniques and new methods and new materials, aluminum and plastics.
Escherich says Eisenhower took the best of those two worlds, bringing in his own background in arts and crafts and his love of the countryside.
And produced pieces like none that had ever been done before, and was using a traditional medium of wood to produce fine art, and not just fine art, but functional fine art.
The museum building itself, a stone farmhouse with wood and stucco additions, reflects Escherich's artistic evolution from the arts and crafts style through German Expressionism and beyond. Inside, nearly everything is crafted, from small light fixtures and coat hooks to large freestanding sculptures, like that of a couple entwined and a horse in motion, to his famous trapezoidal spiral staircase that appeared in the 1940 World's Fair. There are few, if any, right angles. Shapes appear to buckle and bend. Edges go this way and that, conjuring a whimsical world unto itself.
If you had to describe him, organic is the word. Flowing form that looks like it comes from nature. Nature rarely has right angles, and it rarely has straight or parallel lines.
So who was this sculptor of international acclaim who lived in the woods with a copy of Thoreau's Walden by his bedside? Bill Whitaker is curator of architectural archives at the University of Pennsylvania.
Our understanding of Escherich in some ways has been limited by seeing Escherich as a furniture maker. And he himself didn't see himself as a furniture maker. He saw himself as an artist.
Penn's libraries are collaborating with its School of Design, the Orton Escherich Museum, and Hedgerow Theater and Media to explore Escherich's life and work between 1920 and 1940, the friends, places, and passions he embraced, the roots that supported and nourished his growth into a pivotal figure in American modernism.
You have to push down into this earlier period of his life. You have to show this wide variety of art and work that he was exploring at the period to really see the brilliance of the later work.
Escherich was born in 1887 in Philadelphia, married a former classmate from high school, and moved out to the countryside. He set out to be an impressionist painter, but had a difficult time selling his work. Then came a trip to Fairhope, Alabama, where his wife wanted to study progressive education. It was here, says Lynn Farrington, curator of printed books at Penn's Rare Book and Manuscript Library, that Escherich began carving frames for his paintings.
People are more interested in the frames he's carved than the pictures he's painted. He then starts making wood engravings and woodblock prints and discovers that he has an interest, he enjoys it. Then gradually moves into other things as well. He moves into furniture, he's starting to play with angles, he's starting to explore different ways of expressing himself.
The exhibition at Penn has two venues, One at the Rare Book Library includes letters, illustrations, small sculptures, and sketches to explore the larger arts community in which Escherich developed, in Philadelphia and in trips to Alabama, New York City, and the Adirondacks, where he participated in dance camps. He became friends with prominent writers Sherwood Anderson and Theodore Dreiser, as well as Harold Mason, owner of Center City Philadelphia's gathering place for artists, the Centaur Bookstore, which published his woodcut illustrations in books by Walt Whitman and D.H. Lawrence, among others. A lover of dance and music, his first sculptures included dancers and a firebird. He attended the Philadelphia Orchestra, getting to know concertmaster Alexander Hillsburg and later board member Curtis Bach. He was also very involved in Hedgerow Theater. Hedgerow's artistic director, Penelope Reed, says founder Jasper Dieter and Escherich became fast friends.
And he did artwork, graphics, sets. We have a beautiful Escherich table that he built for the actors to eat at. And we have the hammer-handled chairs, axe-handled chairs. And he gave them as payment for acting classes for his daughter.
Escherich made hundreds and hundreds of sketches of performances at Hedgerow. But he actually drew everywhere, Eisenhower says, using his pencil the way most people would a camera.
So you get this kind of travelogue, looking through his sketches of the places he's going and his friends and what they're doing and seeing.
Exhibition designer and coordinator Andrea Gottschalk says Escherich's playfulness is particularly evident in some of the drawings.
We have a sketch of Sherwood Anderson washing himself in the sink. Exposed. We also have Theodore Dreiser getting ready for bed in his big fluffy slippers and not much else. And there's a great sketch of Curtis Bach in his easy chair kind of slumped down, and the annotation on that is Curtis Bach in his easy way.
The second part of the exhibition at Penn, in the architectural archives, displays larger pieces and explores Escherich's artistic evolution during this period. Included are works using what we'd call today found objects. Chairs like the ones from Hedgerow, made from hammer handles. He also turned leftover circular wood shapes from a wheel maker into wagon wheel chairs.
And each chair was different, and each chair evolved over time into a more complex form that then results in a suite of furniture that he does for the World's Fair in 1940.
This show includes a 1928 five-sided farmhouse table and trapezoidal chairs, and a reclining dancer atop a Victrola cabinet. There's a photograph of a fireplace mantle, which is now on display at the Philadelphia Museum of Art from its permanent collection, and other work from the house he designed for Philadelphia Orchestra board member Curtis Bach, one of his principal patrons. With the completion of the Bach House in the late 30s, Wharton Escherich was developing his own curvaceous style and finally making a national and international name for himself. As an artist for whom modernism didn't have to mean metallic or industrial materials, and a furniture maker who crafted commonplace objects in uncommon ways.
Like Cézanne, he taught people to see differently. Sculptors started thinking about furniture and other functional items differently, and people who made functional items started thinking about them differently as well. So he was really bridging that gap between art and craft.
Like his art, Wharton Escherich himself defies easy definition. Embracing music and dance, theater and books, Escherich liked the shore and the mountains, Alabama and New York City, always coming home to a wooded hillside in rural Pennsylvania. An artist who loved to make art and then use it.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Wharton Escherich and the Birth of the American Modern is on view at the Kamen and Kreutz Galleries at the University of Pennsylvania through February 13th. The Wharton Escherich Museum in Paoli, Pennsylvania conducts guided tours by reservation year-round. Among related events, Hedgerow Theatre is staging Theodore Dreiser's An American Tragedy from September 23rd to October 10th. The Philadelphia Museum of Art is now showcasing Escherich works from its collection, and the first weekend of October will host a related two-day symposium.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Temple University, now with 37,000 students, 8 campuses, and 320 degree programs, and hundreds of thousands of alumni, started in 1884 as a neighborhood school of higher education housed in a Baptist temple on North Broad Street. Its growth and role in the evolution of higher education and in the city of Philadelphia is chronicled by Temple history professor and former administrator James W. Hilty in Temple University, 125 Years of Service to Philadelphia, the Nation, and the World. This is, surprisingly, the first full history of the university since its founding by Russell Conwell, a New England-born Baptist minister, lawyer, and orator with a mission to democratize higher education. What Conwell called the Temple idea, to create a people's university, has endured and expanded as Temple has sought to develop relationships both with its North Philadelphia neighbors and people as far away as Rome and Tokyo. James Hilty shared his thoughts with us about Temple's storied history and multifaceted approach to education, as well as its challenges for the future.
I've been at Temple for 40 years, and I've always been amazed that it's a university of great prestige and a long and impactful influence in Philadelphia, but no written history of it.
Really? Not even for the centenary?
No. Wow. No. In Russell Conwell's day, there was a kind of a running history made for the first 40 years of the university, and it was all in his lectures and his sermons, and he actually wrote a couple pieces for magazines explaining how Temple got started. It became more mythology than real history, however. And, of course, it was all wrapped up in Russell Conwell, the man. And in the 1980s, when I was working for Peter Liacouras and the president involved with strategic planning for the university, it occurred to me that the message of the university ought to be gotten out. And we made some strides in that regard, but it was really David Adamany that kind of lit the match and got a few of us together in the history department to begin looking at it as a problem. And then really Ann Hart and Weaver Hart, the current president, then decided for the 125th anniversary there ought to be some kind of a written record, finally put together a compilation of what the university means to the city, the region, the world, and what it really means to all the people who've been here for all of these years.
It really is a sprawling organization in that you can be involved with this institution and not so much the left hand not knowing what the right hand is doing. You can be on the tip of the index finger of the left hand and not know what's happening in any other part of the body. You clearly had to get a better handle on that. What changed in your mind about how you saw the university as you proceeded to write this book?
I think I became prouder of the university as I wrote and as I compiled and put together and pulled together. And I realized over the years that as a faculty member, and I'd been in and out of administrative positions over the course of 40 years, but like you said, you know, there were a lot of many little things that were going on and trying to grab them and pull them together. So I was looking for themes that essentially made Temple stand out and made Temple really unique. And it goes back to the founder, I think. It goes back to the democratization of higher education, the accessibility that Temple offers to people who would not normally get access to higher education. Those things are Temple's major contribution, not only to Philadelphia, but really to the world at large. And there have been many emulators of what Russell Conwell called the Temple idea. One of my favorite stories is that Conwell never was able to land that huge transition-shaping gift. He went to John D. Rockefeller. He went to William Bucknell. He went to Andrew Carnegie. He appealed and was, in fact, very appealing to many of these people who liked him personally and would give him personal sums, but never enough to really transition the university. He worked and struggled for so many years to make that happen, and yet what comes out of all is this notion that it's really a people's university, which is what he called it in 1895 in some of the very first ads about the university. He began to talk about how this was a university intended for the working men and women and their children of Philadelphia. And when you talk about being a commuter school, of course, for those first 20 years or so of its existence, it was really commuting by walking or bicycling from work or from home. It was really a very local institution at first, before there were subways and regional rail lines, and even before there were automobiles.
Final question. What surprised you? Was there one great surprise that you came across in your research for this book?
The early years were a bit surprising at how difficult they were and how many sacrifices had to be made by Conwell and Laura Carnell. Laura Carnell was Russell Conwell's right-hand person and she was the only person ever to hold the title associate president. She basically could do all that needed to be done as president, as Conwell's assistant. But those sacrifices and the many financial exigencies that beset the university from time to time, I've kiddingly said that the subtitle of the book ought to be One Damn Financial Crisis After Another. But in the early years, I was surprised to see at some instances how Conwell just struggled and struggled to make ends meet. At one point, he offered to sell the whole institution to the state. Instead, the state began to provide a biennial appropriation, which helped. It was not nearly enough to cover all of the costs. And we became state-aided between 1911 and 1965, and then state-affiliated in 1965 and a half since. But even that has brought financial crisis in 1977 when the Commonwealth General Assembly couldn't decide on an appropriation. And, of course, just this past year, the General Assembly deadlocked again and refused for nearly 6 months to appropriate money to the state-affiliated universities. So the goal, if you would, and the big surprise that comes to my mind, and I think it is that Temple, if it really wants to think about a next 125 years, it has to become more independent. I think that every graduate of Temple has to understand that some sacrifice was required to get them through, and whatever they could do to help others coming along would not only be appreciated, but I think just be absolutely necessary as we go forward into this century.
James W. Hilty, author of Temple University, 125 Years of Service to Philadelphia, the Nation, and the World. These days, the music of the Beatles is treated with the kind of respect usually given to classical music masterpieces. Artists who are now shaping classical music were in fact shaped by the Beatles, foremost amongst them being Philadelphia's Jennifer Higdon, who has become one of America's most performed living composers. Her relationship with music started with the Beatles' sophisticated breakthrough album, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, which was issued in 1967 and has since sold millions of copies. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns monitored Higdon's first encounters with the disc's newest digital refurbishment.
Every day for more than a year, a certain Atlanta second grader named Jennifer sat down with her brother Andy and listened to Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Revisiting the disc was more than a memory lane stroll, but almost a dissection of what Higdon drew from the music and how it made her the composer that she is today. It was also a lot of fun. When we reached the celebrated Mr. Kite, our chins jutted forward and eyes bugged at the imagination behind it.
Doesn't it sound a little bit like an out-of-control merry-go-round that's kind of like moving through the twilight zone?
Higdon found more to ponder in She's Leaving Home. The mono and stereo versions are markedly different, the stereo being slower. That's the one we listened to.
Quietly turning the back door key. Stepping outside,
that would kind of make sense because this is a waltz, which I hadn't noticed till this very moment. But it, a faster pace, it would have a different feel to it. So, psychologically, does it feel different this one than mono? It must. It must actually feel not so melancholy.
Day in the Life, the climax of the album, still eludes a clear interpretation for Higdon, but she vigorously defends the long final piano chord that has been sometimes mercilessly cut short during radio play.
That's like a composer has marked a fermata and it's not there anymore, it's not allowed to be there. I find that disturbing because a composer often thinks of everything in terms of time. And the decay of the piano is part of that time. It needs to all be there.
Again and again, Higdon noticed the album's change of color and acoustical ambience from song to song, from the dry sound of When I'm 64 to the more resonant Lovely Rita Mitterrand.
I wonder sometimes if that's the equivalent of a camera move that's up close and then pull back so you see the whole picture.
Much of what Higdon said about the Beatles could easily be applied to her music, even though she writes for traditional classical forces. The kind of visual imagery evoked by Mr. Kite is sometimes a starting point for her own pieces. Though the Higdon sound is nothing like the Beatles, composers are most significantly influenced not by surface matters, but by the procedures of their predecessors. The way the Beatles welded together unlikely song fragments on the Abbey Road album is very close to the modular construction of Higdon's earlier works. The distinctly different sound worlds encompassed by Sgt. Pepper clearly inspired a similar effect in the five diverse movements of Higdon's Concerto for Orchestra. Among more recent pieces, the shifting coloristic richness of Dooryard Bloom also suggests how Sgt. Pepper molded her inspiration.
Song of the bleeding throat, death's outlet song of life. For well, dear brother, I know, if thou wast not granted to sing, thou wouldst surely die.
Few cases of artistic transmission are this pure or accidental. Sgt. Pepper came into the Higdon household because her father, a visual artist, liked the album's cover. There wasn't a lot else to listen to in the Higdon household, only Prokofiev's Lieutenant Kiji Suite, some Thelonious Monk and Chet Atkins, and she didn't listen much to the radio. So her listening life was Sgt. Pepper most of the time. Considering that Higdon bought later Beatle albums and loved them, the final question is, why did Sgt. Pepper remain central to her musical consciousness? Could this be yet another instance of Higdon's taste for solidity? Sgt. Pepper was the product of an unusually long intensive work period, 700 hours over 4.5 months, allowing trial, error, and most distinctively, a consolidation of what they were after. Sgt. Pepper is experimental, but the experiments are thoroughly worked out.
When everyone's on the same page and in the same groove, it makes a big difference. I mean, like having an orchestra where everyone has one purpose in mind, you get a better recording in general. If you get everyone and everyone's mood is kind of not in the same place and some people are not into doing the recording, I think you can hear that.
Ironically, the Beatles probably kept Higdon from becoming a rock star. By the time she was old enough to think seriously about what sort of musician she wanted to be, the Beatles had broken up and their artistic evolution, which was so attractive to Higdon, was no longer possible in the increasingly formatted, commodified pop world. But the Philadelphia Orchestra, in contrast, lets her write music like this.
Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. The Philadelphia Zoo is currently featuring a collection of Lego brick animals designed to raise awareness of the plight of endangered and threatened species around the world. Creatures of Habitat, a gazillion-piece animal adventure, is a series of more than 30 life-size animal sculptures crafted from hundreds of thousands of tiny Lego bricks by Sean Kenny. The Lego certified professional created the works at his New York studio on a commission from the zoo. The exhibition also has an interactive component. A page at the zoo's website featuring information, tips, and interactive games also enables visitors to create personal sustainability plans to become part of the solution in helping preserve wildlife and save endangered habitats. I met with sculptor Sean Kenny at the Philadelphia Zoo. What's the scope of this project, or how was it originally proposed to you?
Well, I am a full-time Lego artist, I suppose you could call me, and I do this sort of thing all the time, and the zoo is familiar with my work. So they have these stories they want to tell, and they thought it'd be a really great way to tell those stories. And so they gave me a call, and we started talking about how we could really do this and what kinds of animals we would showcase and all of that. So that was nearly a year ago, and we did a lot of planning, and I started clicking the first two Lego pieces together in, I think it was late October or early November. And so we made over 30 animals that are here. The largest is the polar bear. He has 95,000 pieces in him, and it took about 1,100 hours to put together. Everything all together is nearly 250,000 pieces. So some of the smallest are little turtles and birds, and then there's all kinds of other animals and sizes in between.
You are, as you say, a Lego certified professional. How? Why?
Well, I never grew up. Honestly, I've always been playing with these toys ever since. I found photos of me when I was 2, and I never remember a moment when I wasn't playing with these toys or asking for them for my birthday or whatever. I got older. I went off to college. I took them off to me with my, you know, dorm room, and my roommates thought I was a little weird, but they were engineers and tinkerers, and so after about 3 days, they started playing with them, and they thought it was cool, too. I recall building a center console for my car. I had to put my audio cassettes in a thing, and there was no space, and so I built one out of Lego pieces, because, you know, it's like you need a plastic thing shaped like something, that you can use Lego pieces, that'll do it. It was just always in my life. And so as I got older, I got a real job. I worked in an office. I sat in a cubicle for 10 years, and every day I would go home, and I would play with these toys. It was my way of unwinding after, you know, a hard day at the office. And as I was doing that, my creations became more elaborate and more involved and more interesting and were getting more attention. And eventually, I established a relationship with the Lego company. They had been kind of watching all along, and they were really happy about the kinds of things I was doing. So now that we have a relationship, I can do more of what I do, which is good.
What are the limitations of the material? Because anybody who's played with it either as a child or as a parent playing with a child or even a grandparent playing with a child will realize quickly that it doesn't lend itself to curves, although you seem to have gotten over that with this polar bear.
Well, I think that's sort of the proof is in the pudding, right? You can really create anything with Lego pieces. You know, it's not just square things like buildings or little cars or whatever. And sure, of course, it lends itself well to those, but I really enjoy creating organic forms. That's the most complex thing you can do with little rectangles. But as you said, you can see it, there it is. You know, it's very, very challenging for me, and it's very, very rewarding after it's done to be able to see, you know, the expression in the polar bear's face, for example, is exactly what I wanted it to be. It expresses the right emotion that I wanted it to emote. And that's rewarding as an artist and also something that kids can really appreciate.
And what's your starting point, though? I mean, clearly Lego is your medium, but do you do models? Do you do sketches? How do you know what it's going to look like in the end?
Well, I mean, I do a lot of sketching. I sit down with a lot of photos and I'll build little prototypes or miniatures or portions of what it is I might be making and sort of refine those as I go. It's an organic process. There's no kind of one standard way. Maybe I'll grab some graph paper and I'll draw it on the graph paper. You know, if you wanted to make a circle, for example, you can't make a circle out of squares, but if you had a piece of graph paper and you drew it on the graph paper, well, you'd have a starting point and you could start going from there. That's kind of like what I do.
But the proportions need to be pretty big for you to get into the area of curves.
Well, right, yeah, exactly. When you have something like a polar bear like this, you can be as far away as we are, you know, from, you know, 50 feet away, it looks like it's actually organic. And then you get closer and closer and you start to actually make out, you know, the individual Lego pieces and the blockiness of it, which is cool.
We ask this of painters and sculptors a lot. When do you know that it's finished?
It's never finished. It's finished when the time is up. It has to go in a crate and go out the door. With the rainforest dioramas that I made, actually, I sat here and I looked at it and I said, okay, it's 4 feet across. Let me get out my brown and green pieces. I think I'm going to need about 25 trees. And so I built 25 trees and I put them in and I realized I'm going to need 50 more. Like, this is dense, right? And so I just started building more and more trees and layering and underbrush and adding more animals and vines and more trees and the streams and everything. And eventually I realized I had to stop because it would be so dense and so actually, you know, true to life that you'd never see into the rainforest to see all the cool stuff that's in there, which is sort of the point of the rainforest. But it's never done. You have to kind of say, all right, you know what? This is as good as it'll be. So, you know, I'm always proud of what I do, though, so...
You spoke earlier about inspiring kids to go back and be creative with Lego or, you know, these toy blocks. But there is a message that the zoo commissioned this for, which is an environmental message. What is that?
Well, actually, each station has its own unique message, and the idea is that kids can go around and learn what those messages are. The polar bear, of course, is sort of the quintessential expression of an animal losing its habitat. We all sort of hear the stories, and some people argue whether or not it's happening and all those things, but it's a quintessential image of if you rode your bike to school instead of getting a ride, or if you did something like that, then you're going to help, right? And other dioramas that we have set up elsewhere have different messages. For example, there is a turtle that hatches its eggs in the sands of New Jersey, but it has to cross the road to get from the ocean side to the bayside, and the babies, when they hatch, get run over by cars. And so it's a situation where just simply these motorists are inadvertently creating an endangered species. And so even kids can do something about that. Don't pick it up as a pet. You're actually making it worse, right? And so there's all kinds of things that everyone can do. And so each one of these stations tells those stories.
Sculptor Sean Kenny, creator of Lego brick sculptures that are the centerpiece of Creatures of Habitat, a gazillion-piece animal adventure, an exhibition that runs through October 31st at the Philadelphia Zoo. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony in C under music director Rossin Milnov. Eric Brannon is our associate producer. The show's executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.